That's why for entrepreneurs, there's really two very important things they have to put into place early. And it's the number two thing at the end of my book, Scaling Up. I say, all right, I've thrown a lot of stuff at you. Here are the five things, the five next steps. And step number two is to set up what Jim Collins called a council. And I've had one from the very beginning when I launched my company. And it's a 1 hour conversation every week. It's sometimes if you're a startup, it's with yourself or one other person, but it's different than your operational or executive team meeting. It's an hour where you get to talk strategy. You get to debate it, discuss it, air out your, just hear yourself talk about it. And if you can spend an hour every week on strategy, then you're really going to be able to make some.
Hello and welcome to the Indian Dream Podcast. If you've noticed, we've quietly started a new segment on the show where we host authors that have written business books that we absolutely love. In today's episode, we have Warren Harnish, the author of a bestseller called Scaling Up, How a Few Companies Make It and Why Others Don't. Apart from being a best-selling author, he also teaches executives at MIT and runs a global consulting company. To top all that off, Warren is the founder of Entrepreneurs Organization, popularly called as EO. So, you can imagine the breadth of experience he brought to the table on this episode. As an entrepreneur, there are three key phases of business building. The first is a 0-to-1 journey, where you take an idea, test it in markets, and build a small business around it. Then comes the 1-to-10 journey, where you convert the initial success to product market fit, build a team, and scale it to a few more customers. And then comes the 10-to-100 journey, where you press the pedal and build a large business. The Scaling Up book is one of the best books that helps you understand what it takes to scale from 10 to 100. It's a must read if you're an entrepreneur with a small to mid-sized business. On this episode, we dive deep into two key topics that are important in a scale-up journey, pricing and compensation. One discusses some frameworks and examples to help entrepreneurs think through these topics. Before we jump onto the episode, I want to talk about PushOwl, the sponsor for this episode. PushOwl is a web push marketing app built for e-commerce businesses. Trusted by more than 25,000 brands across the globe, PushOwl lets you turn one-time store visitors into subscribers, send highly visible push notifications, and increase customer retention. Check them out at pushowl.com. All right, with that, let's jump into this fascinating conversation with Warren Harnish. Hi, Warren. Thank you so much for joining us today and taking the time out. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you about the books that you've written, Scaling Up and Scaling Up Compensation, which is the newer book, but also talk about Entrepreneurs Organization. It's a global organization that you started back in 1987. So how about we start right there? Tell us about how the EO came about and how it took wings to, you know, 60 countries now.
Yeah, good. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. EO really got birthed the night that I hosted Steve Jobs for his first public speech after being fired from Apple. You know, he had built his beautiful company to almost $2 billion, and then, you know, the board kicked him out, and he kind of got in a funk, and we convinced him about a year later to kind of come out and tell his story. I gathered about 1,200 young entrepreneurs under 30 out in the Bonaventure Hotel in L.A., and I had Steve Jobs there. I had Michael Dell, Mark Cuban, Kevin Harrington, the infomercial king, Neil Balter, California Closets, many of the young under 30 entrepreneurs. And it was an amazing presentation that Steve shared about what it takes to really birth something, scale it, and then again, have like your baby ripped from your arms. And what surprised me is I thought he was just going to kind of fly in and tell the story and leave, but he stayed. I hosted an event for this ACE 100, Top 100 Entrepreneurs Under 30, but he was standing alone by himself. And I remember turning to Greg Stem, the great treasure hunter, and he found like a half a billion worth of treasure off the coast of Spain, you know, just one of his many finds. And I said, look, it's okay to be independent. It was a phrase that my mentor, Joe Mancuso, had shared. I said, look, it's okay to be independent, but no reason to be alone. And there needed to be an organization for the Steves of the world. And so it was that night. It was actually in 1986, the idea was birthed. Took us about a year to get the money raised and get the founding board together. I brought together about 22, you know, successful entrepreneurs to get the thing launched. And so our official launch date was 1987. And it was a fun event in the Bahamas where we got everybody together, and that the rest is history. Launched an executive program then in 91 with in partnership with MIT and Inc. magazine, and that's still going on today. They still let the old man come back and teach. I'll be there May 19th with our next, finally, new class launching after post the pandemic. And the graduates of that have a program every year called Gathering of Titans, and they just finished that up over this last weekend. So EO today, 16,000 members on the way to 160,000. They invited me to their strategic presentation, and the leadership of EO is really ready to 10X that organization. So there's going to be a lot less lonely entrepreneurs out there on the planet.
I think one of the impacts of EO has also been that it's birthed so many other copycat organizations, if you could call it that. Like in India, we have something called the Ascent Foundation, which is pretty much the exact same thing as EO. And I'm a member, and I've gained so much experience and so much information from that organization. And if it wasn't for EO, all these, I guess, copycat organizations would also not exist. So EO has had a pretty big impact across the world.
Yeah, it has. Really, really proud of the difference it's making.
Yeah. And as they say, right, a founder's job is very lonely at the top. You can't really share a lot with your team members, the vulnerabilities, the problems that you're facing, because you don't want to demotivate them. But you need a group of people where you can share your troubles and you know, sort of brainstorm a lot of these things. And that's where these organizations go a long way. Okay, Warren, let's switch gears a little bit. Now, the Indian economy, the Indian sort of entrepreneurship ecosystem right now is being is in a very interesting flux. For the last few years, we've had a lot of venture capital come in. A lot of startups who've been funded at decent valuations have a lot of capital, but are now looking at the scale-up journey, and which is not really straightforward, especially, you know, sitting in India, probably selling to the world or even selling to India. And on the other hand, we have these traditional family businesses or organizations that have been running for the last 20, 30 years, and they're now at the cusp of, you know, some of them are going to become really big because they've figured out a niche, they've figured out how to work. But all of them, almost all of them, have a challenge of switching gears and go into the scale-up mode. A lot of these companies have figured out the 0 to 1, maybe 1 to 10. But when it comes to 10 to 100, they struggle a lot. So tell us, you know, on a very high level, the four levers that you talk about in the book.
Yeah, and that is the challenge. In fact, we work with a lot of the companies there in India that have been around for 120 years that are massive and still doing business. And so, you know, there's plenty of startups, 11,000 every hour in the world. So we're not hurting for new companies. It's, as you said, the challenge is how to scale it up. And I've got an MBA that's supposed to teach how to run a big company, and there's incubators on every corner, but where's the parenting manual that really helps you grow up that venture? And as you arithmetically add people, that's in relationships and customers and product lines, you geometrically increase the complexity and chaos. And so that's what I spent 10 years trying to figure out at this MIT program as we moved about 1,000 CEOs through it, many very well known today and running significant businesses. You know, what are the levers? And it really came down to four. I don't know that business is that uniquely bucketed this way, but in general, you've got to get four decisions right. And that is around the people, the relationships that you attract to the business, employees, customers, board, investors, attention. You know, so there's the people issues, strategy. The riches are in the niches, and you do need to make sure that you have really focused your strategy. Number three, then, you've got to execute on it. It does you no good to sit around and talk about it and have a plan if it doesn't happen. And then, you know, you can get by with decent people, decent strategy, decent execution, but not a day without cash. Growth sucks cash. And so you got to make sure that that component is alive and well. So people, strategy, execution, and cash. And we've created a set of tools that help leaders think through, again, the decisions they need to make, because that's all success is the sum total of all the decisions that you and your people and you get the market to make. And so it comes down to influencing those decisions.
Yeah. What I really liked about the book was how detailed it is in order to sort of give a blueprint, as you said, a parenting manual on what it takes to actually scale up your organization, right? I want to double down on one specific aspect, especially relevant to the Indian ecosystem. When we speak to entrepreneurs here, a big question is the cash crunch, right? Hey, like my vendors are not paying me on time, or sorry, my vendors want the money on time, my customers are not paying me on time, and just in that soup of not having the cash to actually grow the organization. And within the cash component, you've spoken about pricing, and in the new book, you've spoken about compensation. I'd love to sort of double click on both these aspects and your experience with, you know, with dealing with a lot of businesses on how they think about cash and what kind of strategies they use.
Yeah, we actually talk about in the book how companies, if they're not careful, can start growing broke. You know, so, hey, you think things are going well, you know, you've got the revenue flowing in, you got decent gross margins, you even have profit, but the cash isn't there. And that's when you end up getting in trouble. And so getting on top of that, and one of the things we see is entrepreneurs just are not really paying much attention to even the cash statement that their accountants are creating for them. They'll grab the P&L, look at the top line, look at the bottom line, say, hey, looks like there's something there. And all of a sudden, they can't make payroll. So you're right. We want to take a look at, we have a tool called the Power of One. And it really allows you, by putting your numbers in a very simple software system that we've got, that we partner with Alan Mills on, you can see your own business model sensitivity to seven decisions. The first being price. You know, almost everything it takes to market a business, product, price, place, and promotion, you got to spend money to make money. But price is the one that can drive money to the bottom line and give you cash immediately. And the reason that we get price so wrong is that we're dealing with people. You know, even in business to business, you're not selling to a company, you sell to people. And one of the things we learned is people are not rational. You know, they're not logical, they're psychological. And so when it first comes to price, you need to pay attention to it. Entrepreneurs are so obsessed, obviously, we call it the founder's factor. You know, they're frugal, they know they've got to really watch their costs, and they get obsessed on the cost side. But when it comes to setting price, they kind of just, it's a wild ankle guess. And so to give you a sense of just how psychological it is, the godfather of influence, Dr. Robert Cialdini, did an interesting just experiment. You know, if you go to a restaurant, you know, and I've been to plenty of them there in India, we actually lived in Hyderabad for a while and been to, you know, Sri Sri Ravi Shankar's ashram in Bangalore. And we've got a lot of clients over there. Anyway, if you go to a restaurant and they give you a wine list, you know, typically the wine list is listed from least expensive to most expensive. All you have to do is reverse the order of the list and put the most expensive at the top and the least at the bottom. And you'll drive about 26% more revenue on average. You didn't change a wine, you didn't change a price. And then if you anchor it with some really expensive bottles of wine, you can actually pull revenue up 250%. It's not logical, but it's psychological. And that's the first point. You can move your top line and your bottom line that's ultimately flowing to cash by hundreds of percent if you just get more focused and clever around your pricing strategies. The second thing we have to realize around price is that all the unicorns, all these companies that have gone from zero to a billion, they really don't have a fixed price. You know, if you start with, you know, the online retailers, you know, my book's price changes. It has changed just $6 in the last week. On Amazon, there's no, you know, put a sticker on it and only change it when it's going on sale. If you look at the share ride services, you know, your typical taxi's got so much per eighth of a mile or eighth of a kilometer. Here it's based on demand. Same with now airline pricing and everything else. There is no fixed price. It's a negotiation. It's an exchange. And we need to particularly pay attention to that in the business to business realm. And so there's an article we've been encouraging because, you know, there's a lot of information on consumer pricing, many about what I just shared. But a lot of folks say, well, what do I do in the business to business scenario? And it's an HBR article called Good, Better, Best Pricing. And you can just Google it, good, better, best. You could probably share it out with your audience. And it really emphasized the fact that we have a tendency to put in one price or one bid if it's a competitive marketplace. We can even have a client for many years and it's come up for rebid. And we know that there's going to be some new entrants into the market. They're going to just want to lower the price so they can steal the relationship from you. And it becomes frustrating. How do you really signal to the client that what you provide is much more valuable in total to them than just maybe the immediate price of the product or service? And so the recommendation is you always submit three prices. You always submit three bids, a good, better, best. And on the good, what you want to do is rather than list, you know, we're always talking about how you've got to sell features and benefits and, you know, the things that people are going to get. But that's not why people buy. You know, again, back to the godfather of influence, Robert Cialdini, people do more to avoid a loss than to get a gain. That's why the media spins up all the horror stories. They don't want to talk about anything good. Yeah, you'd think the world's falling apart every single day if you watch the news. So what you want to do is on the good price where you're matching the low, you know, ball price in the marketplace, you want to list everything the client is not going to get at that price. You're not going to get design support. You're not going to get quick response from our team to support your team, to support your clients. You're going to make a laundry list of everything that you're going to lose at that low price. And that way you also shine a light on it so that they'll go talk to the folks who've got the other low price and say, wait a second, you haven't even mentioned what you're going to do. Because a lot of times your client just assumes there's things that come with automatically the service or product that you're providing that they don't appreciate what you're doing for them. And this really shines a spotlight on it. Then at the better price, you want to make that loss list less. And obviously at the best price, hey, you're going to get it all. Now, we just had a client, John Summers, Allied Printing, had a major significant global client put up their project for rebid. And they put in the good, better, best. And it worked. But the client said, all right, you win. We need everything that you've listed. We weren't even aware that you provide that and how much we need that in order to serve our clients. So I want the best, but I want it for a better price. And he's like, I should have set the price that I want to be the better. And then you set the high price, the best price, and add some things that you know the client doesn't mind throwing away. So you can meet halfway in between. And so what they did is they met halfway in between. And that's what you want to do also with pricing, is you want to make the customer feel like they won. And so how you set that initial price, what you bundle with it are really important strategic decisions. And again, you can move that top line needle significantly that ultimately flows to cash if you can get the price right.
Before I read your book, Varun, I never thought about pricing as much, right? And one thing I love about your book is that you have so many recommendations of other books you should be reading. So when I read your book, I think I read a dozen other books after that. And one of the books that I read was Confessions of a Pricing Man by Herman Simon that you recommend in your own book. And I didn't know you could have an entire book just about pricing. And when I read that, I read about like cost plus pricing and all these other different methodologies for pricing. And it shook me that like, hey, I have never thought about pricing at this level. And like you said, like, because pricing can drive revenue in such a significant way. Pricing can drive your cash in such a significant way. And it's such an important thing that I don't remember if you mentioned it in your book or if Herman mentioned it in his book, that it should be the CEO's office that is always driving the pricing decision. While a lot of times pricing decisions are being driven at the salesperson's end, right? I think that distinction is also quite important, that I don't know if a lot of businesses are doing that.
Yeah, you're right. The CEO at the end of the day, according to Michael Porter at Harvard as well, is to drive strategy. That's your number one job. And that includes pricing strategy. and compensation strategy. They're part of the strategic mix. Let me share one example. I was back at the reunion program, this MIT executive program that I founded, and we were talking about price because, see, as Herman Simon subtitled his book, price affects everything. It really affects people's perception of your quality and value. And so there was a guy in the audience who's got a SaaS offering that solves a fairly significant problem for large companies, but he wasn't able to sell any of them. His salespeople were failing. And it was only $2,500 a month. It was $30,000 a year. And so he finally said, look, I'm going to go out and talk to some of the potential customers and figure out why they're not saying yes. And so he goes out to see them and, you know, gathering intel is the way you win all markets and all wars. And you've got to get it firsthand. So he goes out and he talks to a couple of customers and said, look, you guys have a big problem. And they're like, yes, we do. And he says, and we have what we think is the elegant solution for that. And they said, it appears you do. Then he said, well, why aren't you buying it? It's only $2,500 a month. And they said, essentially, because it's only $2,500 a month. We don't believe that you can solve this problem for that little amount. We don't think at that amount you're going to be around in order to support this long term. And one of the customers, they're never going to say it to you directly, but they intimated that, look, we've got 10x budgeted to solve this problem because it's so big. And that gave him an idea. And he went back and he essentially 10x'd the price. He didn't just increase it, you know, 20% or 50. No, he went from $2,500 a month to $25,000 a month, a $300,000 offering. And overnight, they started selling faster than he could almost support them. And so we can be off by factors of 10. In terms of our pricing. And so I just want to make everybody aware of it and get them to spend more strategic time really testing it, gathering market intel, and being much more clever around how you set price.
So this kind of pricing might work for a SaaS offering where it's not really tangible, but when you're talking about physical goods and when you're talking about things that are like actually manufactured, a lot of times the pricing, the customer themselves knows the pricing. They know what the raw material inputs are. And they know that, hey, this for this weight of copper, it's going to cost this much to buy it, blah, 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 and the processing fee. And then how do you deal with pricing in that situation?
Well, you know, if you're in a pure commodity market, you're going to end up with commodity-like margins, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4%. And that's okay. If you're really operationally efficient and you're more efficient in delivering on that, then, you know, we've got supermarket chains that average 2% profitability and still our clients are at 8% because they're able to be much more clever in their operational side and their hiring. And, you know, there's a lot of costs that you can save if you're better, you know, in terms of execution. So that's why execution is one of the, you know, four important areas. But look, the riches are in the niches. And, you know, our hope is that you have figured out a way to add some value to what is that commodity. So, I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, office furniture really is a commodity. I mean, you can get it from anybody at any place. Folks know what it is. I can go online. I can buy it used. But one of our clients realized two things. That the ancillary services around that, for instance, having the furniture lifts so that you could come in and move the carpet squares around so that, you know, you don't get the wear patterns. And that allows your carpet that you've got in your office to have its life extended. That's a huge cost savings. And the margins on those ancillary services are like 15% net instead of the 2.8% net that you have on office furniture. They also realize that it's the last mile that is the challenge. How do you actually install and, you know, set up and install office equipment and office furniture? And that is the part of the business that all dealers hate dealing with. And so he set up a service that provided the delivery and installation for all kinds of competitive office furniture and office equipment companies. And his net is like 22% on those kind of services wrapped around a commodity product. And so, look, Sermon Simon has an article in Harvard Business Review that if you want to be the low price competitor like IKEA, but you still want to have a great profit margin. They were at 13% up until their founder died. There are seven things that you have to do, and you've got to do all seven, or you're going to end up making 2% instead of 12%. So get that HBR article that Herman Simon wrote that really is an augment to his book. It's called, Low Price, Herman Simon, HBR.
Perfect. Yeah, we're going to link that in the show notes. One of the other things that I think a lot of entrepreneurs do is look at how the competitors are pricing it and then anchor it somewhere there. And I think that's, again, to your point, not the right way to go about it because you're not differentiating at all, even in the pricing. And the other curse that I think a lot of Indian entrepreneurs face is, I call this the middle class morality that we've all grown up in. That humility, that honesty, that whatever, however, the words that you associate with it, where you don't have the audacity to go ask the 10x price, like you sort of mentioned in the example. I think that's something that we probably need to get out of as we sell to the rest of the world. Let's switch gears to compensation aspect of it. That's another common problem that a lot of Indian entrepreneurs face. Especially as they're going from, family managed or, managed within the family versus now professionalizing it. The competition aspect that people face and the common complaints that people have, the entrepreneurs that we've spoken to, is there's lack of talent in India. And what they're really saying is they're not ready to pay top dollar for top talent. And tell us a little bit about how you think about scaling up compensation.
Sorry, before you go into that, Vern, I just want to tell you a little story about my experience with your book. So when we booked the meeting with you about a month ago, that's when I picked up Scaling Up Compensation. And just out of pure coincidence, the day I bought your book, my head of finance and my HR head, they barged into my room. They showed me a presentation. They were like, Sahil, this is why we need to change compensation at the company. And at that moment of time, I knew that it wasn't the correct way of doing it, what they were presenting to me. But at the same time, I didn't have any framework to think about it. I was like, how do I think about it? Then I remembered, oh, I just bought this book by Vern Harnish, and I have this framework. So I just spent the entire day. I read the entire book. I took detailed notes. I went to the whiteboard. I laid out the entire framework that you provided. And then your framework turned into my framework for thinking about how to do compensation. And then that is literally the framework that I presented to my board, that, hey, we should do compensation in this way. And it really, really helped, because earlier I didn't have any way of thinking about compensation, because thinking about it at a first principles level, at such a deep level, was something I'd never done. And your book really, it helped me at a moment where I really needed it. So thank you for that. But yeah, let's go into what you talk about in Scaling Up Compensation and what you suggest that compensation should be framed as.
Yeah, well, and to frame that, we really see compensation as pricing inside. And it's as tricky because you're dealing with people again, right? You price to people and you set compensation with people, and they're not logical. They're psychological. And so there's a lot of psychology that has to go around to setting up the compensation systems. And we really rooted our five design principles. It comes from over, my 40 years of working with leaders of growth companies and seeing what works and doesn't. And my co-author, Dr. Sebastian Ross, in his background as well, and working with many of the companies where we're able to really prove out these ideas in real firms. What it starts with the fact that two things. One, everybody thinks compensation is this private conversation between the employer and the employee. Yet, what you've got to realize, there's two other really important relationships involved in this decision. And that is the other coworkers, because that's one of the problems. as you scale up, you just start piecing together deals. You know, I cut a deal with this one person, I cut another deal. This one comes in, says, I'm going to leave. So you cut another deal with them. And before long, you've got this mismatched mess. And employees do talk. And if they can't, if there's no way that if your compensation scheme was printed on the front page of the local business newspaper, could you justify it? So you have to realize those other two in the relationship are the other employees and probably equally important, the customer. You know, at the end of the day, if your compensation system isn't reinforcing what it is that the customer most values that you provide, then you're going to end up with kind of a conflict. The second is we know that that compensation is only one piece of all of the other levers that you can pull in your culture. And so generally, you just want to get it right and out of sight. You want to be able to just kind of take it off the table so it's not creating a lot of drama in the organization so you can get on with the other cultural things that allow you to attract and retain talent. And like pricing, the first design principle is you've got to be different. I love the fact that you said at the essence of strategy is you've got to be different. And that's Michael Porter again at Harvard. So if you're pricing the same way as all your competition, you're not different. And if you're compensating in roughly the same way everybody else in your industry is compensating, then you're not different. And so you've got to bring the same kind of strategic fit so that your compensation aligns with both what the customer wants, what the other employees want, and that it makes you unique. So let me just give you an example that I think will highlight that. I'll take you down to Brisbane, Australia, to a company called Mini Movers. You know, it's not Facebook, it's not Google. They move people's furniture. And by the way, attracting and retaining that kind of talent is difficult for all companies. So here's what Michael Hagan did. He said, let's first of all start with the customer. What are the two things the customer most wants? Well, the second is just get my move on time. But the number one thing is just don't break anything. You know, I don't want to see a scratch on any of the things that you're moving. Now, how does the industry typically handle that? Well, they have insurance. So if you know, something's damaged, the insurance company pays for it, and it represents about 3% of revenue. And Mike's thinking, why am I paying that money to the insurance company? Why don't I pay that to my people? So what he did, he kind of gamified it. He said, look, each move, I'm going to take 3% of the revenue of that move. And the team that executes the move, if there's any damage, it's going to come out of that pool of money. But if there's anything left, you don't do any damage at all, I'm going to share that with the team, which, by the way, represented about an extra 1,000 Aussie dollars a quarter, 4,000 a year. And then way before the customer is going to get upset, it's going to be the fellow movers. Employees are going to say, look, we got to support each other. We got to train each other. We got to help each other, make sure that we don't do any damage because this is really, affecting all of our pocketbooks. And so look what it does. First, it gets all the teammates aligned and supporting each other. And by the way, they're going to be the first to say, hey, I think we hired an idiot here and we need to get them out of the company. You don't have to fire them as the boss. And way before the customer gets upset, they're going to get upset with each other. Number two, it delivers what the customer wants, which is no breakage. And by sharing what he was spending on insurance with the team, he's actually able to pay his people more than everybody else in the industry, which provides a way for him to attract and retain that talent. So alignment with culture, alignment with what the customer wants, it creates team alignment, and he's got higher paid people, all with just making this kind of simple change to his compensation approach. And that's what you want to achieve.
One thing that I think a lot of, especially Indian businesses, are scared of is this kind of profit sharing, because I actually don't know why they're afraid of it, but oftentimes when you use the word profit sharing, and in fact, when I had to make the presentation to my board, I had to take out the word profit sharing anywhere and use some other fancy word. But I guess, why do you think that people are afraid of profit sharing, and what do you think are the big benefits of having a profit sharing scheme of this sort?
Yeah. Well, by the way, you wouldn't even call this a profit sharing. This is kind of gamified, taking a cost component and shifting it from the insurance companies and turning it over to the employees. So he didn't really call it a profit sharing, but let me address profit sharing.
But I think calling it gamifying in my presentation to my board would have been even worse, because calling some compensation scheme gamified compensation would be even worse, I think. Yeah.
Well, they need to get over that, because, you know, the industry that's figured this out better than anyone is the gaming industry. You know, the casino industry, they get people to sit there all day at a computer screen losing money, and they don't want to take a break. They don't have to pay them, you know, and they'll work all night. I want you to think about just how crazy that is. And we address that in the book. The gaming industry understands human psychology better than all the other companies combined. So we should take advantage of that. But let me address the bonus thing specifically. And if you're going to pay out bonuses based on profit, first, we really recommend you only do that once a year and sometime after the end of the year. And your employees will come to you and say, but look, I'd like the cash now. Would you pay it quarterly? And the problem, if you pay bonuses quarterly, it starts to feel like base pay. It becomes expected. And now if something happens and you don't hit the profitability, now you're having to take something away from people. And to give people something and then take it away is worse than giving it to them in the first place from a psychological perspective. And that's why people get frustrated with profit sharing, because it feels just like an entitlement. Like, I'm just paying it out and I'm not getting any additional productivity or results, anything that I can measure. This is why Bank of America, who last year, 2021, paid out to all their employees a $750 bonus, and they realized it was just a waste. You know, it wasn't enough to keep anybody or attract anyone. And yes, they're appreciative for about a day, but it's not going to really change any behavior. So what do you do instead? Again, I want to go back to John Summers at Allied Printing. First, you want to pay people well and have wide pay bands. And because one of the things that people are always asking for is a career path. Hey, what's my career path? Well, if you're a small to mid-sized company, you don't have any management levels. Hopefully big companies are even get rid of those. And you have to realize a career path is just code for how do I make more money? And so the first thing you want to structure is wide pay bands. So the person that's in the same job, if they can achieve certain milestones and results, can make up to twice as much in that same position. And by the way, think about in sport. Do all the players who play the same position on a cricket team all get compensated the same? No, it's widely different compensation for professional sports players, whatever the sport is, depending on your capabilities and skills. And one thing we recognize is that not all people produce the same. As Bill Gates famously said, one right programmer can replace 10,000. And if you don't have this ability to differentiate that with your comp schemes, what you're really shooting for is this. I would rather have a whole lot less, better paid, productive people than a whole lot more, lower paid, dumb people. All right? You just have to sort of make this decision. So what John does is, first, he has very wide pay bands. You can make twice as much in your job as a customer service rep, as a project manager. And you can make 10x as a salesperson. Then number two, the overall company bonus then is paid sometime after the end of the year, but only 50% of that bonus is paid. The other 50% vests over the next several years. And so what it does, it creates these increasingly larger pots of money in the future that if I leave, I'm leaving that money on the table. And that goes back to people do more to avoid a loss. So what did Bank of America do? They said, we're going to take away the cash bonus because it's not doing any good. And we're going to replace it with, and why we've been pushing companies actually to go public sooner than later, but they gave all their employees stock. It ranged from about $2,700 to $27,000. But here's the key. It vests over the next 4 years. And so their theory is that employees are going to be less likely to leave if I've got that bigger pot of money or stock sitting on the table that I'm going to lose if I do. And we'll see how it plays out. But that's what we're seeing inside of our own clients is structuring it. Now, if you do feel pressured to pay bonuses quarterly, again, the fear is, hey, we had a couple of good quarters. Now I've had a bad couple quarters, but I've already paid the money. Now the company's in trouble. So what you want to do, according to Jack Stack's great game, is only pay 10% of what would be the total bonus in the first quarter, 20% second, 30% third, 40% fourth. And by the way, if we missed our numbers in the first quarter, that 10% rolls over to the next quarter. So the pots of money get bigger as the year progresses. But if you end up having a bad quarter or a bad year, since you only paid out a little bit of it in the beginning, you're not going to be hit so hard from a profitability or cash standpoint. So again, a lot of detail in the book around setting bonuses properly. And what you really want to be careful of is the short-term bonuses, because people just start treating it like an entitlement.
That makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that I got out of this discussion was how a lot of entrepreneurs need to spend time on these intangible things. And this is the curse of sort of running a small to mid business where you're completely occupied with day-to-day operations. You're not thinking 5 years, 10 years ahead. You're not thinking about these strategic decisions. You're just fighting fires on a very, you know, everyday basis. And this is something that I think entrepreneurs need to get out of so that they can take the pricing decisions, so that they can do the compensation decisions. And I'll leave the audience with one more example that you spoke about in the book, the Outback Steakhouse. I think that was a fantastic example of incentives alignment and how he sort of tackled the attrition issue. We're not going to talk about it. You'll have to read the book to actually figure out what that example was.
I just wanted to clarify one thing. Sorry. In the book, you spoke a lot about sales incentives for salespeople and making that fast, or like having that be more frequent. Are you differentiating when you talk about bonuses? Are you differentiating from the sales incentive versus the bonus for the entire business?
You got it. Yeah, we do discuss that salespeople are a unique being inside organizations. They need, you know, frequent reinforcement because they're dealing with a lot of no's. And so how you set up their commission structure, it's not so much a bonus. Generally there, it's commission-based. We address that separately. And I do want to go back to something you said, and that is the issue. When it comes to pricing, when it comes to compensation, when it comes to deciding the niche you want to pursue, how you're going to differentiate your product, all these strategy decisions you can't work on once a quarter or once a year. That's why for entrepreneurs, there's really two very important things they have to put into place early. And it's the number two thing at the end of my book, Scaling Up. I say, all right, I've thrown a lot of stuff at you. Here are the five things, the five next steps. And step number two is to set up what Jim Collins called a council. And I've had one from the very beginning when I launched my company. And it's a 1 hour conversation every week. It's sometimes if you're a startup, it's with yourself or one other person. But it's different than your operational or executive team meeting. It's an hour where you get to talk strategy. You get to debate it, discuss it, air out your, you just hear yourself talk about it. And if you can spend an hour every week on strategy, then you're really going to be able to make some progress. The second is if you're going to design strategy, you need a design studio. And we just call it the studio. And I was on stage with some folks from Disney's creative innovation side of the business. And the guy asked an interesting question. He said, where do your best ideas come to you? You know, for me, it's the shower. I take these very long showers and the whole bit, and people, you know, walks. And you know what's interesting? Everybody mentioned something except the office. You can't really have any breakthroughs when you're in the office fighting fires. So John D. Rockefeller, the namesake of my first book, he worked from home each morning where he could really get some quiet time to think and work on the business. Then he would go in at noon. My partner, John Ratliff, had a second condo that he would go to that was set up with nice views like I've got here overlooking the harbor that you can go. He could go escape to do his strategic thinking and work on the business. And so I think every entrepreneur needs this second place where they can kind of hide out. And for me, when I moved 6,000 miles away from our headquarters to Barcelona, Spain, even the time zone was beneficial. I wasn't even getting any emails from my team till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And so I had all morning to really work on the business, even in our early days, that helped us take it globally. And I don't think I could have done that if I was in the office every hour of every day. So having that 1 hour council, which for me is 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. every Monday morning, and it's with the CEOs of our three different companies and an outside advisor. And then having an escape, a studio where you can do this work, are the two routines that will help you spend time on strategy.
There are so many things we haven't spoken about from your books. We haven't gotten to cash, but luckily we had a long conversation with John Mullins about cash. So I think that covered a lot of the cash part of it. We haven't covered the execution, which I learned so much from your book about execution as well, about those, the cadence of meetings on a weekly basis. I thought I knew how to do it before, but then, I started doing it much better after the book. Thank you so much, Varun, for this conversation. And it was really fantastic. I'm sure a lot of people from India will love and learn a lot from the book and from this conversation as well.
All right. Take care.